You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
It's called On the Ocean, the Mediterranean, the Atlantic from prehistory to AD 1500.
It's about the Mediterranean Sea and its links to the Atlantic.
All right, welcome to the show, everyone. Because of some technical difficulties, my co-host April could not be with us for this recording, so it's just going to be me. But that's fine because I have a fantastic interview with Sir Barry Cunliffe. He's a British archaeologist and emeritus professor at the University of Oxford, and he was professor of European archaeology at the University of Oxford from 1972 to 2007. Welcome to the show, Barry.
Thank you very much.
All right. So is there anything you want to add to that introduction that'll help us talk about this, like something in your past or your history that you want to talk about that's related to what we're going to talk about today?
Well, I suppose the only thing that's vaguely related is that my father was in the Navy and so was my grandfather. So, and I grew up in the naval town of Portsmouth. So I'm very much aware of the sea.
Excellent. Excellent. I was actually in the U.S. Navy and did a crossing of the Atlantic in an aircraft carrier.
So it's rather safer than some of the boats I'm going to be talking about.
I would imagine. So what we are going to talk about is your upcoming book, On the Ocean, and this is published by Oxford University Press. Why don't you just give us a little preview? You know, what is the basic idea about this book, and then we'll get into some of the more specifics about it. So, it's called On the Ocean, the Mediterranean, the Atlantic from prehistory to AD 1500. So, give us the quick back of the cover idea what this is about. Okay.
Well, the front of the cover says it all, really. It's about the two seas. It's about the Mediterranean Sea and its links to the Atlantic. And what I really wanted to write about was how the two seas interacted with each other, or rather, people on the two seas interacted with each other. And it all sort of starts in the Mediterranean with the development of quite complicated shipping, and then spews out into the Atlantic. And really, the story ends, as far as I'm concerned, when the Atlantic is no longer a great open sea. Because in most of the prehistoric and historic period, of course, the Atlantic was unending. I stopped the story in about 1510 AD, which is a very convenient date, by which time most of the American shore is known. So the Atlantic, instead of being great open ocean, is closed off by the landmass of the Americas, which sort of gets in the way, because people used to think you could sail from Europe straight across to India and China. So it's really about that story. It's a sort of narrative about people and people's very, very special relationship to the sea, and of course all the technology that goes with it.
Right. So why did you choose to stop at AD 1500? Why did you choose that time period?
Well, that was when the explorers called the Cabots, John and Sebastian Cabot, sailed from Bristol in western part of Britain and discovered quite a slab of North America. Before that, a bit of North America had been found by the Vikings about 1000 BC. Then you've got Columbus finding the Caribbean in the 1490s. About 1500, Amerigo Vespucci is sailing along the coast of South America right down to Patagonia. So there was only a little bit missing, which was North America, and that was discovered by these explorers from Britain between about 1500 and 1510. And by that date, most of the American coast from Newfoundland down to Patagonia was known. So the Atlantic is no longer the great exciting place it was. It's just any other ordinary enclosed sea. So that was a good place to stop.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will say, first off, speaking as an American, we're finally starting to get the history properly told here, and we're coming up to it again with Columbus Day coming. And you didn't mention Columbus once, because everybody here thinks Columbus discovered America. And
right.
I mean, we know that's not true.
we know he was one of the people who discovered bit of America. Yeah. But we can go a lot back. There's a fantastic man called Eratosthenes. Who was a Greek writing about 300 in the 3rd century BC. And he knew, as the Greeks did by that stage, that the world was a sphere. You could sail around it. And he actually said, if you set off from essentially Spain, Portugal, really, if you set off from Portugal and you sailed along the latitude, so sailing along the latitude you could do by sort of working out where the sun was and everything. If you sail along the latitude, you would hit Japan and nothing would get in your way. Now, he said that, and then he was quoted about 100 years later by a Greek called Strabo, who says just that. And then he says that those who set out to do that journey and return to tell the tale says that they came back simply because the sea was so lonely. It was nothing got in their way or anything, but they just couldn't go any further. They had to turn around and come back. Now, the key bit was those who set out to do that journey and return to tell the tale. So I think we've got to think of people all the time throughout later prehistory and the early historic period, sort of trying to get across the Atlantic. Some of them may have done it long, long before the Vikings got to Newfoundland and that area. So, you know, there may have been Romans hitting the coast. There may have been Phoenicians even hitting the coast. We just have no evidence at all about it. But the spirit of people in the prehistoric period wouldn't have stopped them taking up the challenge.
Yeah, and that's really interesting because that's obviously a common question over here is who was the first, you know, to arrive to this coast? And we have, I think, fairly clearly evidence of like Vikings landing on the North American coast, the New England coast and things like that. But I don't want to talk about North America too much, of course. I want to bring in, you know, some of the key points in the book. But I guess what's the earliest that you discuss in the book and how is the scrap that. How is the book laid out? How did you choose with such a broad, what seems like to me, such a broad topic? How did you choose to lay the book out the way that you did? Because I noticed you've got chapters on like navigation and things like that. So discuss that a little bit.
Well, I think the first thing I do when I'm writing a book like this, or indeed any book that deals with sort of geography, is to decide what sort of geography I want. And I do like maps that shake you out of your complacency a bit. So in this book, for most of the book, the top of the map is west. So that means the Mediterranean is sort of turned on its side, as it were, from the conventional view. And that's the way I think people thought in the past. They start navigating in the Mediterranean, and they gradually explore the Mediterranean from the south end, further and further north, and then out into the Atlantic, and then across the Atlantic. So first of all is laying it out geographically. So all my maps are skewed to this particular sort of direction. It is essentially a narrative. I think archaeology lends itself to narrative. You're telling a story. You're telling a story of people. So it has a chronology about it. I do break off in the middle when the technology gets a bit complicated and shipbuilding sort of really takes off. And this is in the Greek and Roman period. I have this chapter called it's about technology. It's about the technology of ships and so on, and it's when things happen very fast. But essentially, it is a narrative, and it takes the story from really it's about 120,000 BC up to 1510 AD. Wow. It plays off what's going on. It's not a straight narrative from the Mediterranean out to the Atlantic, because things are going on the Atlantic coast at the same time as they're going on in the Mediterranean. So we're sort of flitting from the Mediterranean and then taking the story over to the Atlantic, taking it into the Baltic Sea, back into the Atlantic. So it's what's happening when, as time moves forward.
So before we get into it a little more, I want to know a little more about your motivations behind writing the book. Was there nothing like this that has existed for this kind of scope? I mean, besides your awesome family history with the Navy and living in a port town, you probably just grew up interested in this subject. But why write this book? What do you hope people get out of it?
Well, to start with, I'm a sort of a basic dirt archaeologist. You know, I dig holes and mm-hmm. find evidence, and I work on land usually. But I've had this sort of long interest with the sea and with maritime archaeology, and I'm involved with various maritime archaeological things. I did think that the maritime archaeologist and the dirt archaeologist didn't really talk to each other. They mm-hmm. they had their own narratives. They had their own interests. The maritime archaeologists were telling us a huge amount about the development of shipping, but that the dirt archaeologists weren't relating that to how culture was changing, how ideas were spreading, how technology was being transferred from one place to another. So I thought what I wanted to do was to bring people back into the story. After all, archaeology is essentially about people. It's not about things, it's about people. Bring people back into the story and look at the sea and navigation from the viewpoint, as far as one could, of the people living at the time. What was their horizon? What was their technical capability? And what was their motivation? Why did they get on ships? Why did they sail? Did they fear the sea? How did they play Kate, the gods of the sea, and so on. So it's that's essentially what it's about, trying to look holistically at the position of the sea in the lives of ordinary people.
I'm really interested in sailing technology too, so I'm going to ask a bunch of questions about that. who were the first people to really have sailing technology that took them, I guess that took them long distances? Because I know there were probably more primitive types of sails. If I'm not mistaken, weren't the Chinese some of the first to have sails?
They did have sails, yeah. Fairly early on, but it goes back long, long before that. I mean, the bit of evidence that I still find very, very difficult to get my mind around comes from the island of Crete. Mm-hmm. And it's a very recent piece of work which has shown that there were humans on Crete about 120,000 BC. Now, that's very, very difficult to get your mind around because Crete has been an island since then. So to get to Crete, even as early as that, you would have had to sail across a large slab of open sea. There's no doubt about it. If the archaeology is right, and I have no reason to disagree with it, it looks perfectly sound, good, solid archaeology to me. If that is right, then people were capable of sailing across a substantial stretch of sea 120,000 years ago. And this was the time when even before modern Homo sapiens had developed. It was when humans were still developing. Yeah. And that is a mind-blowing concept. Now, how they did it, I suppose you could say, if you take it absolutely minimally and don't mind a bit of incest thrown in, you could say that the simplest explanation would be a pregnant woman holding onto a log. You know, that's how you could people another land or an island or something like that. But it's infinitely more complex than that. It must be that groups of people settled down and they decided they wanted to take to the sea for some reason. Goodness knows what that reason was. And then they designed a craft to do it. It may only have been a few logs tied together or some bundles of reeds or something like that. But they wanted to do it. They designed something to enable them to do it. And then they set off to do it. Now, this is an incredible piece of adventure. And it says it sets the scene for the whole of the rest of the book. You know, people were attracted to the sea. They were challenged by the sea. And in the end, they wanted to beat the sea.
That's great. And it's really interesting. You mentioned Crete. I mentioned in the early on that I was in the Navy, and I was actually on the USS Enterprise. And one of the places that we stopped was Crete. Like, we went up Pierside in Crete, which was crazy to see this this Greek island. And I wasn't an archaeologist or anything then, and I wasn't even really knowing I was going to go into that that sort of career. So I was still looking at it from kind of a touristic standpoint. But standing on Crete and then looking out and seeing that kind of ship and then seeing all the other boats around there was kind of fascinating. However, I'm just wondering, you know, because you mentioned, you know, they must have had some kind of technology, you know, that long ago, 120,000 years. So when do you think, when can we pin down a generalized time period when people really took to the sea? But it doesn't sound like we really can in the concept of like the Mediterranean, because they always lived near the sea around islands and things like that. So it seems like it was always just a part of their lives.
Yeah, I think it was. I think again, we've downplayed it too much in the past. I think I think that if you were a hunter gatherer, you know, before agriculture or before anything sophisticated, if you're just plain hunter gatherers, the most congenial environment you could live in would be the coastal environment, because you've got everything there. You've got the woods inland where you can hunt. You've got the littoral, the coastal zone itself with all its seaweeds and its shellfish and things like that. You've got the estuaries, which absolutely teem with wildlife and birds and fish and so on. And then you've got the sea. If you want to take to a boat, you can go and fish. So everything you want is in that little narrow strip, which is along the edge of the sea. And so I think that was the really congenial place where people... well, large numbers of people congregated, and where they the channels along which they moved. So from very early on, they would have been used to going into the sea to fish, or going on a few planks or logs tied together to get out to an island where they knew the fishing was good. It would have been inbred from a very early stage, from this hunter-gatherer stage. We mustn't forget, too, if we just move briefly out of the Mediterranean and Atlantic, that humans were sailing across great stretches of sea to get to Australia. They couldn't get to Australia unless they took to the sea. And I was hearing, I think it was only yesterday, that the earlier states now for humans in Australia go back to about 65,000 BC. So we're way back in this sort of hunter-gatherer period. So I think that's when it begins. And much more to the point, I think that's when navigation begins. Because if you're a farmer, and you are sort of nailed down and tied to your ground, and you can't go away because someone might pinch your crop. You've got to be there to weed it and keep the predators away and so on. You're not very mobile. But if you're a hunter-gatherer, you're constantly moving. You're following your flocks or the herds. You're maybe following shoals of fish, following the flights of birds or something like that. You're moving away from your home territory, sometimes over very considerable distances. You need to be able to come back, and you need therefore to be able to navigate, to understand what the stars and the moon and so on means. So I think you've got everything going for you in that hunter-gatherer period that turns you into a good sailor.
Excellent. Well, we're going to take our first break right now, and then we'll come back in about 30 seconds and continue this awesome discussion about the book On the Ocean with Sir Barry Cunliffe. Back in a second. Hey, podcast fans, check out the ARC 365 podcast at www.arcpodnet.com/ARC365. That's ARCH365 for your daily dose of archaeology. Each episode is less than 15 minutes long, and we have some great guests recording about awesome archaeology. We also try to throw in some definitions and basic archaeological information. So check out the 365 Days of Archaeology podcast only in 2017 at www.arcpodnet.com/ARC365 today. Find us also on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Music by typing ARC365 into the search. Now back to the show. Okay, we're back, and I'm talking with Sir Barry Cunliffe about the book On the Ocean, available soon, as you're listening to this, from the Oxford University Press. So, Barry, I wanted to talk a little bit about the transmission of technology, because it seems like unlike stuff, you know, I'm a archaeologist over here in the United States, and we talk about, you know, transmission of, say, like projectile point technology, arrowheads, things like that, you know, how do forms transmit. And that seems like it would be a much slower process just because of the way people move around. But the minute people take to the ocean and they take to the sea, they're traveling longer distances just inherently. Now, probably not early on, because like you were talking about in the beginning, when people first started being, you know, living near the sea and experiencing the sea, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see a log floating around and thinking, well, if I attach two logs together, maybe I could float around or something like that. But you need bigger vessels. I mean, like I mentioned, when I was in the Navy and we were parked in the Bay of Naples, they wouldn't let us, Naples, Italy, wouldn't let us come up to Pierside with a ship with 8 nuclear reactors on it. Go figure. And right. So we were way out there, and we were actually outside the bay, and I mean, the swells, just on a normal nice day, the swells in the Mediterranean coming over that ship, they were like 10-12 foot swells, and I couldn't imagine doing that on something smaller. So that was the one limit to I would say, in my experience, that would be the one limit to traveling long distances. But when do you think people started having larger vessels? Let's just say the Mediterranean, for example, so they could start really far-reaching exploration and seeing what else was out there.
Well, can I come back to the small vessels later? I don't want to miss that one. Let's park that on one side because you can do a lot on a small vessel. But to focus on your question, I think one of the crucial sort of bits of development happens in Egypt. Because the whole of transportation and movement and everything in Egypt depended on the river, they developed river transport very fast. If you can sail down a river easily, but you can't sail up a river easily unless you develop a sail and the right sort of technology to go with it. So Egypt was a very early forcing ground for all these things. And very soon after sort of 3000, in the third millennium and after, Egypt started trading with the coast of the Levant, the Levantine coast, which is now Israel and Lebanon and Syria, that sort of bit of coast at the east end of the Mediterranean. So you get the technology transfer of Egyptian shipping and everything they've learned very, very quickly to the east end of the Mediterranean. And then it's picked up by other people there and developed very fast. So I think that's probably the main growth period in the Mediterranean. But if we can hop now to what was happening on the Atlantic. On the Atlantic, they were almost certainly building skin boats at that stage, which would be just wickerwork frameworks with skins sewn on the outside and properly smeared with fat and so on to be waterproof. And these boats... and various classical writers talk about them. They must go right back, I'm sure, to this hunter-gatherer period we were talking about earlier. Ideal, because you can pick it up and you can pick a skin boat up and carry it. They're very, very light, or two or three people can carry quite a large one. And they bob up and down on the ocean absolutely brilliantly. There's a writer, a 20th century writer, who had a lot to do with skin boats on the island of Arran, which is one of the islands off the west coast of Ireland, where they still have skin boats. I've actually been out, well, not skin anymore, they use canvas, but I've actually been out in one. And this writer talks about this wonderful experience of just bobbing on the waves. You feel you're just skidding across the tops of the waves. And they were brilliantly designed for Atlantic breakers and so on. And just to give an idea of what those skin boats could do, in the 8th century AD, Irish missionaries were sailing from Ireland across to northern Scotland and sailing from the north of Scotland up to Iceland, up to the Faroe Islands and up to Iceland. And it took them more than 6 days sailing north into sort of nowhere. Before they got to Iceland, they were looking for remote places for religious reasons. They were probably guided by sort of flights of birds and things like that. You know, if you see these geese flying north, the hooper swan particularly, flying north, you want to know where it's going. You know it's going to land somewhere. So you know if you follow that course, you'll probably find land. And that's how they discovered, in the 8th century, they discovered Iceland, which was completely, it may have been discovered before, we might come back to that one, but they found Iceland and settled it. And they did that on these skin boats, and it took more than 6 days in the open ocean to get there. So you don't have to have a big impressive boat to take to the sea.
That really brings back to circle that back around to Eastern North America real quick. To think that we've always been taught and thought that this whole side of the world wasn't discovered until, you know, the late 1400s, early 1500s, just seems incredibly naive, because these people, it sounds like, you know, once they took to the ocean, whether they were over in the, China in that area, or the Mediterranean, the North Atlantic, I mean, they were really far reaching and far ranging in where they were going and exploring. And I'm not sure if the motivations were specifically exploration. I don't know if you can speak to that at all, or if it really was just survival, looking for new places.
No, I very strongly believe that exploration, just the sheer hell of exploration, has motivated people through time.
For sure.
I think if you just step back a bit and think, you know, man, oh, I shouldn't say man, humans mm-hmm. are animals. And we share things with animals. We know, first of all, our first instinct is to feed ourselves. Second instinct is to reproduce, and third, perhaps, to look after our young. Those sort of basic instincts we share with animals. Mm-hmm. But humans differ from animals in that, A, we've got imaginations, and we can create scenarios which are not real, and those develop into religions. And we are acquisitive. In all senses of the word, we want to acquire stuff to make us look impressive. A lot of this useless yellow metal, which we turn into jewelry and hang around ourselves, for example. We want to acquire stuff, but we also want to acquire knowledge. And in the past, there's plenty of evidence that acquiring knowledge was of immense importance and gave people status. So I think based on this sort of whole bit of our hardwired genes, which make us acquisitive, that is what drew us into the sea in the first place and made us look across the sea and see an island and say, well, let's go and find out what's on that island. And then when you get to that island, well, I wonder what happens a bit further over. Let's just sail out for a couple of days and find out. And I think that's hardwired into us.
You know, because of that inquisitive nature and the way you can take even a small vessel and go long distances, which they've proven, can you map, I'm sure you can, but has somebody mapped the transmission of technology and the evolution of different types of technology? Because it seems to me like if you're a seafaring people and you're on one type of vessel and somebody shows up in a huge sailing vessel or something like that, then I'm going to want to adopt that technology pretty quickly.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of the big debates, you know, were there independent developments of bits mm-hmm. of technology, or was it transferred, or what was the combination of all? If you just take the sail, for example, which is an interesting bit of technology, the Egyptians were using the sail certainly by 3000 BC, and it was all around, it got all around the Mediterranean very, very, very quickly. When the first sail is known to have been used on the Atlantic, and I say is known to have been used on the Atlantic, is in the first century BC, and there is a little model of a boat with a mast and a sail from Ireland dating to the first century BC. Now, so by the first century BC, there were sails on the Atlantic. And the question is, when did they get there? Did they get there from the Mediterranean? Was it an independent invention? And some archaeologists go back and point to a boat that was found, the remains of the boat found in Dover, in the seaside town of Dover, in the harbour of Dover, about 20 years ago, I think it was now, a boat that dates to 1500 BC. And it was a seagoing boat, a plank-built boat, sewn planks, big thick planks sewn together. They reckon that you could put a temporary mast up in it. And they've actually built a replica of this boat and put a temporary mast in, and it sails brilliantly. So it's quite possible that even back that far, people had got the idea of the sail. It's not, after all, a very complicated bit of technology. So, but there is another possibility. If you want it to be technology transfer, the first time that a Mediterranean sailing ship went through the Straits of Gibraltar into the Atlantic was probably about 1000 BC. And that was with the Phoenicians. They went through the Straits of Gibraltar and started trading in southern Spain with people producing metal, silver in particular. So that would be a gee whiz moment when all the people on the Atlantic, if they hadn't already got the sail, suddenly saw one and thought, we ought to have one of those. So you can have it either way. We don't, you know, archaeologically, we can't tell. The only bit of evidence that we could get is if we could find evidence of a sail on an Atlantic boat before the Phoenicians got there. And then we would be able to talk about independent invention.
Right. And correct me if I'm wrong, because every time you see some, archaeological report or survey or something like that regarding, a ship that was excavated or something in the Mediterranean, it always seems like every single one of them looks different. And I feel like boats in particular, unlike, like I said, what I study here, projectile points and things like that, you can have a shape that's working for people and persist for 3,000 years, that just never changed. I mean, there's slight, morphological differences in the shape of the arrowhead or projectile point. But it seems like boat and sailing technology, there was a high amount of variation. It's almost like, man, if it floats, let's not add any more to this. So I guess what I'm going with that is, can you do like some sort of like seriation exercise when you look at these boats? And I mean, you can sure go from smaller boats to larger boats, I'm sure. But as far as the technology of the ships themselves and the boats themselves, can you see a progression of certain types of technology related to those ships as they get through time?
Yes, you can. More or less any area you look at, you can pretty well work out a typology changing through time. In the Mediterranean, for example, some of the earliest boats were plank built. They were planks were made and then sewn together. These early Egyptian boats were sewn plank technology. And that went on for a very long time. One of the earliest boats that went down off the Turkish coast that we've got evidence for, dating to about 1500 BC, was a sewn plank boat. But that technology was already in existence on the Atlantic. I think you have limited options. If you want to stick two planks together, the easiest way to do it is to sew them together. So that isn't a complicated technology. But as soon as you want to start nailing the planks or nailing the planks to cross members, then you need good bronze nails or good iron nails. And you can see gradually some bronze nails coming in, and then you can see iron nail technology coming in. And that really did change things, because it meant you could make much more robust vessels by hammering these planks to cross members and to floor timbers and so on, and make a much more solid ship.
That actually leads right into another question I wanted to ask, which is, what other technologies have you noted that can be directly related to their development with ship and seafaring technology? Because right off the bat, I wasn't thinking about iron technology and things like that, but I was thinking map making myself. How much did map making, was that driven by boats? But anything else you can think of as well?
Well, take up map making. Yeah, I think there's no evidence of really good maps being made until the Roman period, but before that, of course, you had oral tradition. You had what was called the periplus, which means a sailing round, essentially. A list of sailing instructions, which very rarely are recorded. There's a periplus of the Indian Ocean, which was how you sail in the early Roman period around the Indian Ocean. And this was a lot of sort of wisdom taken down and written down, and the document survives. But in our area, there is a periplus that is incorporated in a much later Roman poem. I won't bore you with the detail, but the Roman poem is 4th century and it's awful. And the guy who wrote it, 4th century AD, the guy who wrote it wanted to show how clever he was by quoting lots of texts. And one text he quoted was this periplus, which is probably dates to about 500 BC. And it's sailing instructions from somewhere on the coast of Portugal, around through the Straits of Gibraltar and into the Mediterranean and up to Marseille, which was the great port of Massilia, at the time, one of the great Greek ports. And it gives you everything you need to know, like when you pass around the cliff with the temple on it, you come into a bit of muddy water. That's where such and such a river spews out its silt. And then there are three islands on your left. You know, everything that you need to know to be able to make that journey. It doesn't make for easy reading. And it's certainly not poetry. But my guess is that this periplus idea was a sort of verbal tradition that one sea master taught, probably sang, to another, and it was passed on in that way, possibly as a sea chant or something of the sort. So you've got that sort of thing. But also, it's quite clear that if you read Homer, the Iliad or the Odyssey, there's a lot of sailing goes on in Homer. And it's quite clear that the people who did the sailing carried in their minds a map of where they were. You know, they had this this mental map of the sea, and they could locate themselves in it in almost an eerie way. And I think that's what you get from generation after generation after generation on the sea.
Okay. Well, I've got a handful of more questions, and this is fantastic. But so we don't have to cut you off, let's go to our last break real quick, and then we'll come back very shortly with a wrap up of this discussion of On the Ocean with Barry Cunliffe. Back in a second.
This network is supported by our listeners. You can become a supporting member by going to arcpodnet.com/members and signing up. As a supporting member, you have access to high-quality downloads of each show and a discount at our future online store and access to show hosts on a members-only Slack team. For professional members, we'll have training shows and other special content offered throughout the year. Once again, go to arcpodnet.com/members to support the network and get some great extras and swag in the process. That's arcpodnet.com/members.
Okay, we're back, and we're talking with Barry Cunliffe, the author of a forthcoming book from Oxford University Press called On the Ocean. And we've talked about some motivations behind the book in the first segment. We've talked about some sailing technology. And I want to continue talking about that just a little bit in the first part of the third segment, because I was thinking when you're talking at the end of the second segment about this kind of oral tradition and knowledge about sailing, my first instinct, it would be that people initially stuck to coastlines because it was easier to navigate, because celestial navigation, I studied that a little bit when I was in the Navy just for fun. It wasn't what I did for a job, but I was, you know, I was out on a ship, so I figured let's learn about the stars. And, you know, it can be incredibly complex because the stars move and things like that. And to me, and to other people living in this century, that's probably a really complex topic. But when you really think about putting yourself in a prehistory mindset, they lived with the stars all the time. They didn't have cities blotting out the stars, and they were aware of them a lot. So I'm wondering if you know, what evidence we have of celestial navigation coming in to play for some of those more open, not only like crossing the Mediterranean, the Mediterranean looks small to people on a map, but it's actually massive. I mean, you get pretty quickly, you can't see any land. So, you know, it's not easy to just sail all the way across the Mediterranean unless you know exactly where you're going. And then, you know, getting out into the open ocean, of course, you have to be able to navigate and understand where you're going. So what are some of the early evidence we have towards celestial navigation? Or is it just how could they have done that without it?
Well, definitely in Homer. So Homer, mm-hmm. written down about 800 BC, but referring to perhaps a tradition going on hundreds of years before that. Homer, his various heroes know all about celestial navigation. They talk about the stars and where the stars are and so on. So there's no doubt by that stage they were perfectly used to it. And I think one of the easiest forms of navigation is to do to sail down the latitude, as they called it. So if you want to take the sort of east-west along the latitude, you can, so long as you keep your favored star height at the same height at the same time of night, you know you're sailing along the latitude. And that's a great strength. And we can see the Vikings use this, for example. When they wanted to sail across to Iceland, they knew that they had to sail either up or down the Norwegian coast to a particular point, and then take to the open sea and sail along the latitude. And if they stuck to the latitude, they'd hit Iceland without any difficulty. And then there are actual sailing instructions, Viking sailing instructions, which start off in the same way and say that when you've got a certain distance, you should see a bit of Shetland on your left, and you should see the birds or some of the clouds in the sky over Iceland far to the north. And then if you carry on, you'll hit Greenland. So they knew exactly what they were doing in sailing along the latitudes. And I think the Phoenicians did that in the Mediterranean. You're talking about the size of the Mediterranean. The Phoenicians, who lived on this Levantine coast mainly in sort of Lebanon, Syria, that sort of area, sailed regularly the length of the Mediterranean. And you can more or less chart what they did. They set off from their favored port and sailed along the latitude so that they were sailing along the south side of Crete. And actually, Homer tells us this. He sailed with a Phoenician and said that they sailed along the south side of Crete. You don't touch it. You just see it and you know where you are. And if you sailed on and on and on that latitude, you'd hit Malta or thereabouts, which is where they had one of their bases. Then you'd be able to easily navigate around Sicily and across to Corsica and up the coast of Corsica, where they had another one of their bases, then sail on the latitude again, and you'd hit Ibiza, one of the Balearic Islands, where they had another one of their major bases. And then from there, you can see the Spanish coast and move on. So they navigated the whole length of the Mediterranean, using wherever possible, sailing along the latitudes when they were out of sight of land. So I'm absolutely convinced that way back into the Paleolithic period, people were totally able to do this. One thing was, remember, of course, there was no North Star then. The North Star wasn't where it is now, and which made it a bit more difficult. But there's a man called Pythias, who I'm very interested in. He was an explorer about 320 BC. And he talks about positioning north in relation to the stars around it. So he could establish from the stars where due north was. If I can just take up a bit of Pythias, because he was particularly interesting. He wanted to know, you know, if you can sail along the latitude, that's okay. You know, you're 3 days along the latitude, and if you get some idea how many kilometers or whatever it is you sail in a day, you can work out where you are. Going north is much more difficult. And what Pythias did, and remember, this is about 320 BC, he was a Greek who lived in Marseille and made a journey to the Atlantic and circumnavigated Britain. It's an amazing journey. I've stolen the title of the book from him. He wrote a book called On the Ocean. That's where my title comes from. And he's a great hero of mine. What he did was to take the sun height, or rather calculate the height of the sun at midday on the midsummer solstice at Marseille. And that gave him a latitude. And then he sailed on and on and on further north. And then he did a whole series of these sun height measurements, going further and further and further north. And he recorded them, and they've come down to us. They're quoted by another Greek. And they can be converted into latitudes. So you can see how far north he was sailing. And the most northern latitude he recorded is equivalent to the island of Shetland, which is right off the north coast of Scotland, way north of the British Isles. So he was wanting to know where he was going, and he was capable of making measurements to show him.
You know, that's so interesting because as you mentioned, for millennia, people are figuring out this navigation in their own way and different ways. And yet they don't seem to get a lot of credit for that. I'm saying that because I read a book called Longitude by Deva Sobel.
Oh, yes. Yeah, excellent book. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a great book. I read it a number of years ago. I just looked it up here. It came out in 2007. And that talks about the story of basically solving the problem of longitude. And you have to read the book to, you know, listeners out there have to read the book. I'll put a link to it in the show notes to find out what that means by that. But it's basically, you know, coming up with a really accurate clock that works at sea and figuring out time. Yeah.
It's a great book. I can thoroughly recommend it. Yep.
Outstanding. So what? Why was that? And I know this goes up into a little later than I think your book talks about. But why was that considered a massive problem when it seems like for centuries and centuries before that people were handling navigation, you know, relatively fine? Why did that? What problems did that solve? Solving the problem of the longitude.
By that stage, you needed much more delicate measurement. Mm-hmm. In the earlier period, it didn't much matter. This was really for world sailing around the world. You needed these much more precise measurements. To give you an example. We mentioned Columbus right at the beginning. Well, Columbus, wanting to know how far it was from Spain across to India, to China, where he wanted to get, or India, all he could do was to work out what the circumference, or take the circumference of the world, mm-hmm. work out what distance Marco Polo had said it was overland from Italy to China. Marco Polo had been overland, and then subtract that distance from the circumference of the world. And he came up with a figure of, I think, 7,000 kilometers. He was a bit out. It was 17,000 kilometers.
Yeah.
So you could make big mistakes. And that's why Columbus would never believe that he hadn't hit India or China. Because when he hit America, it was exactly where he believed, with his bad measurements, that China or the Asian coast ought to be.
Wow, that's crazy. I'm so glad back to Columbus again. You know, I'm so glad that we're learning more and more about him in a real from a real standpoint. I would honestly don't think that it's going to be too long before Columbus Day here. Some cities and states actually are actually changing Columbus Day to like Native. I think I heard one called just like Native American Day or something like that, where we're just just translating it. Yes. But I would like to see something honoring, you know, early discovery to begin with, which is what kind of the spirit of that was. But anyway, that's a different conversation.
and a dangerous one too. Yes.
That is a dangerous one. So I like to see one of your chapters is called Into the Outer Ocean, and it says 600 to 100 BC, which is again amazing to me. That reminds me of another sort of tangential question. So the Egyptians had sailing technology, I think, what did you say, 3,000 BC they were sailing
3,000,
on the about 3,000 on the on the Nile there. Did the Egyptians ever take that technology outside of that environment, outside of that area? Because you never hear about that.
No, they didn't. And there's an interesting story about this, because there was an Egyptian pharaoh, a man called Necho, around about 600 BC. And he came up with the idea that you could sail around Africa. Hmm. And rather than doing it himself, or rather getting Egyptians to do it, he hired... so the story goes, he hired the Phoenicians to do it, because the Phoenicians were the good sailors at that time. They were known to be good sailors. The Egyptians just weren't used to the outer ocean. And the story, it's told by Herodotus, so it's a decent Greek source. Herodotus says that, so what he did was to get these Phoenicians to build a boat in the Red Sea and to get on that boat and sail around Africa and tell them to come back, into the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. And Herodotus says, it took them, the story goes that it took them 3 years to do it. And they planted, they stopped off every summer and planted crops then moved on for the next year and so on. Eventually in 3 years, they came back. And then Herodotus says, but I don't believe this story. It's too fanciful. And he said, one of the things they said was that when they got right down in the south to go round, the sun kept on appearing on their right-hand side, and that shows that it's nonsense. Well, it doesn't. It actually proves that they probably did get below the equator, and the sun was on their right-hand side as they were sailing around Africa. So, I think it's an open possibility that these Phoenicians, who were the most amazing sailors, did actually take up the challenge. They probably paid very well for it, take up the challenge and sail around Africa.
Nice. So back to the chapter about into the outer ocean, 600 to 100 BC. Who were some of the first? I think we've touched on it, but who were some of the first to just sail? I guess from the Mediterranean standpoint and from that standpoint to sail west. Who were some of the first to just start doing that?
Well, I think most people will have, whether they were Phoenicians or Greeks, the Greeks did come out into the Atlantic, would have stuck to the coast, would have sailed down the coast. We know the Phoenicians sailed right down the African coast, the Atlantic African coast, at least around to Cameroon. And they sailed up the coast a bit as well. The Greeks sailed out into the Atlantic. We've got this Eratosthenes that I mentioned, this Greek who said that he was writing in the 3rd century, said if you set off from Spain and sailed west, you could hit India and China, and hinted that people were doing it. The trouble is, we've got no hard evidence except one very dodgy bit of archaeology, and that is on one of the islands in the Azores, right out the Azores, Portuguese territory, right out in the middle of the Atlantic, almost midway between Europe and America. One of those islands, Corvo, which is the westernmost. In the 18th century, they claimed to have found a hoard of coins there. And that hoard of coins was taken back to Portugal, and they were drawn by a coin expert and so on. So we've got drawings of them. They are Carthaginian coins, there's no doubt, dating to the 2nd century BC. Now, if it was a genuine find and it wasn't a fake, then the Carthaginians had at least got that far. And that doesn't surprise me at all. That's the only piece of evidence so far. You can think of other reasons. It could have been an 18th century collector who had a collection of Carthaginian coins. Mm-hmm. It could have been someone in the 17th century who'd faked the story because he liked the idea of the Phoenicians. We don't know. The coins don't survive. The fine spot has produced nothing. But there is a possibility that the Carthaginians were exploring west. There are other hints that people were exploring. In the Roman period, a pot was dredged up about 80 miles off the west coast of Ireland, and it's a Roman pot. It was dredged up in the 1920s, and it can only have got there from a ship. Now, perhaps that was a ship blown off course out into the Atlantic. Perhaps it was someone actually sailing in the Atlantic to try and get across. We don't know. So there are lots of hints like this. There are Roman coins on the island of Iceland, dating to the 3rd century. It's before the Christian monks got there, 500 years before. So there could be Romans going north and exploring. So there are all these possibilities. That's one of the great excitements about archaeology. You can say we don't have any evidence of this. But it doesn't mean to say that evidence isn't going to appear eventually. So we always keep our fingers crossed that something might happen. And someone did a very, very interesting piece of work recently. It was only published a couple of years ago, looking at the statistical possibilities of being taken to America by drift from the Canary Islands. So if you got on a boat in the Canary Islands and just allowed it to drift, what were your chances of getting to America? Mm-hmm. And he worked out it is a very, very high chance indeed, a surprisingly high chance. I think it was a 60 or 70% chance. Mm-hmm. You've been taken around by the Northeast trades. It's the way the sea works. And indeed, that is exactly the route that Columbus used. Yeah. Columbus sailed from Spain. Well, he did, but he sailed down the coast to the Canary Islands and started off from the Canary Islands because he knew that the Northeast trades would take him in the direction he wanted to go. And if he knew, well, people before him knew as well.
Right.
So how many people might have made that journey? We just don't know.
Hmm. Well, this has been a fascinating discussion, and I'm excited for other people to see this when this book comes out. Your last chapter is titled Reflections on the Ocean. What did you learn from writing this book? What did you gain from it, from completing this, you know, putting all this in one spot?
I think probably an even greater respect for the sea than mm-hmm. I've had before, and a greater respect for humans who were prepared to engage with the sea. There's one 19th century writer, Victor Hugo, who talks about, he says navigation is essentially a conflict. It's a conflict between man and the sea. And these early navigators who took to the sea and often didn't know where they were going and often weren't totally in control of the technology for doing it, they were competing with the various gods of the sea as they perceived them to be. And for them, it was a challenge, as it still is when people get on a rowing boat and try and sail around the world, or get on a boat and try and row to the North Pole, as they've tried to do mm-hmm. recently. It's the same spirit, and it's that human spirit coming through that I find fascinating.
Excellent. Well, again, thank you, Barry. Thank you for coming on the show. And thank you for writing such a what sounds like such an amazing book. And I'm excited for other people to get their hands on this. And I can think of a few people I know in particular that are really going to like this book. They're involved in, you know, nautical archaeology and things like that here in the United States. And it's just such a nice, comprehensive volume. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, the book is On the Ocean, the Mediterranean and the Atlantic, from Prehistory to AD 1500, by Barry Cunliffe, available at Oxford University Press. Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show was produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks, and in the meantime, keep learning. Keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day. This show is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.